This is Teacher of the Ear, a show presenting conversations of learning, teaching, and technology, listening for ways to empower educators and champion student agency. I'm Chris Friend from Kane University. My guest for this episode comes to us as the result of a typo. Seriously, in my conversation with Hannah McGregor in episode 18 on scholarly communication, Hannah mentioned a concept that she attributed to one Brenna Clark Gray from Thompson Rivers University. Being the responsible, thorough scholar that I am, I completely failed to fact-check that bit of my episode transcript, which accidentally referenced a Brenda Clark Gray that nobody seems to have heard of. When a screenshot of that transcript and my associated typo went out on Twitter, the real Brenna Clark Gray stood up and said she'd like to meet this Brenda person. I got all sorts of ashamed, looked her up as I should have done in the first place, fixed the typo, and then, as one does, immediately subscribed to her podcast as penance. This is the part of the narrative where I could say, and it was all downhill from there, or where Brenna might say, and that was your first mistake. But no, trust me when I say, Brenna's show is downright joyful. There's a marketing spin, Brenna. Come for the guilt, stay for the quality? I don't know. I'm getting ahead of myself here, though. First, let me introduce you to Brenna.
Hi, my name is Brenna Clark Gray. I'm coordinator of educational technologies at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, BC, in beautiful Tecumloops Te Sequepin territory in the unceded and traditional lands of Sequepin Ulu. I make a podcast at TRU, but it's for everyone, called You Got This, and we talk about different teaching and learning concerns, and I interview a brilliant member of my community every week to talk about the work that they do.
Two things stand out to me about Brenna's podcast. First, she hosts the show from the position of a learning technologist, but she's constantly critiquing the tech she discusses. You'll often hear her talk about some tool, acknowledge what she doesn't like about it, then discuss a particular use case that works well for a given situation. That balance of critique and application is simply refreshing. The second thing that stands out about her show will at first sound shallow, but hear me out. Brenna's giggles make me smile, and she keeps them in the final cut of her episodes, where others might edit them out to try and sound more, I don't know, allegedly professional or scholarly. And that's why I appreciate the giggles so much. They make her human. We get to hear her honest reactions to things, and we get to hear the joy she takes in having conversations and thinking about her work. In a world where scholarly productivity can often be stuffy and dry, hearing someone giggle about the madness of edtech, or her theory that her child just licks everything at daycare, is, again, refreshing. Brenna's attitude in her show is what I would call unabashedly hopeful, and she directly addressed that concept in a recent episode, ending with this.
I want you to help me wrestle with this idea of optimism versus hope. Can you tease them apart? Do you see how they're separate? I guess what I'm going to ask you to do is think about to what extent your approach to teaching in your discipline relies on an optimistic view of the future. I'm curious what this little thought experiment of the distinction between optimism and hope would mean for your classroom.
But instead of answering her question, I wanted to hear more of her thinking and see where the conversation might take us. Spoiler alert, we went all over the place. Oh, and before you cringe at the prospect of us being obnoxiously cheerful, rest assured we knew from the start that this was a tricky time to discuss the topic of hope in education. And that's exactly why I think it's important to bring this conversation to you in the current moment. Our discussion springboards from the conversation I had with Kate Denial in the previous episode on kindness. Kate started that episode differentiating kindness from niceness by explaining that, in her words,
I think niceness lies. Niceness will do anything to paper over cracks. It will say and do anything to keep a version of the peace.
And here's Brenna's reaction to that.
Yeah, it's so true and such a lot. And niceness lies, and also niceness masks and hides the truth often, right? Like, niceness makes me think of civility, and it makes me think of, you know, polytests and like the ways that Canadians perform racism differently than Americans, for example, right? And this notion that what matters is the surface, which is what niceness is. Niceness is the surface, right? But yeah, kindness is difficult. Like, kindness is hard work. And I'm increasingly interested, like, in open I jokingly refer to it sometimes on the podcast as open as in hearts, not open as in source, which isn't to say I don't think open source is important, but like this is where the pieces like honesty and transparency and clarity in our interactions with students become so, so powerful. And this piece, you know, in your discussion with Kate, the things that you don't want to hear, faculty often find themselves, I think, in a really difficult position when they try to pursue honesty around institutional structures with students, because so much else that they are hearing is not honest, right? It's wrapped up in marketing and sales. And I think that much like kindness, honesty is hard work, and honesty is facing the absolute unknowability of the future as we understand it right now, which is very different. I don't think previous generations of instructors had to wrestle with this in quite the same way, which isn't to say that there was marketing, right? There was lies. There always is. But, you know, there was student loan debt and the massive sort of scam that all is and all of that. That all existed. But we had this sense, right? I remember as an undergrad, like really believing that like there was this sort of like arc to history and things progressively get better. And that was naive even then. But I think a lot of my professors held it. Like a lot of my professors thought that with every passing year, we were improving, progressing, making more things better for more people. I'm not sure how you stand in front of a classroom of students and sell that now, if honesty is important to you. And then I'm having this conversation with Naomi Hodgson about hope and this very simultaneously like mind-bending idea that you can distinguish hope from optimism. And this very necessary sense for me that I have to find some idea of hope in the present in order to continue doing the work that I do and feeling effective in my role. And Hodgson wraps this idea of hope up in purpose, right? So like your hope in the present is tied to your purpose, and the work that you're doing with students is about helping them to find purpose, as opposed to this sort of forward-thinking idea that education has that you're going to go into the world and make it better in some way, right? We all may want for that to happen, but, you know, for the last 5-6 years, it hasn't really felt like one year has gotten better than the last, right? It's felt like a pretty distinct sort of slide downwards. And so this question of, can we maintain a sense of hope without necessarily having to believe in optimism, because optimism can feel kind of impossible and like really hard to access from time to time. So yeah, I'm still really wrestling with this. Like I'm not going to be providing you with any sort of polished articulation here, but I think it's a really useful thing to start to think about. If we can't promise students a better world, if we can't promise students that they will be able to fix things, can we help them find a sense of purpose that doesn't rely on the idea that we may be able to fix everything in the next generation? Because that's feeling increasingly not super likely. We do work within institutions that are making a series of guarantees that I think are increasingly tenuous. And I like the idea of faculty asking questions about that and helping students to ask questions about that, because I think that that's really important. It can also be really frustrating for the student who's sitting there with a student loan in hand, who's been told that XYZ will come out of completing this degree, and being ready for that conversation to be uncomfortable, I think is really important. But yeah, you know, I don't know what 5 years from now is going to look like from the perspective of climate. There's all kinds of really concrete ways in which the world seems to be shifting under our feet. A friend of mine described it when the Roe decision came down on Friday, described it as feeling like we had spent all this time climbing up a mountain. We hadn't even gotten to the top, and now suddenly we're sliding back down again. But like when you look down, the ground isn't where it was before. Like there's been some kind of tectonic shift and sea level has dropped somehow.
That metaphor of feeling like we're sliding back down, I appreciate the metaphor. I would argue that it's worse than that, because we've been pushed. Mm-hmm, saying that we're sliding back down makes it sound like it's just this natural occurrence of gravity. Yeah. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. But no, there was someone else on the mountain, someone perhaps higher up the mountain than we are, who has pushed us to ensure that we are falling.
Oof, that's a good metaphor.
Or not, but
well, yeah. But you know, I'm imagining like further up the mountain, higher up in sort of privilege and power and prestige and just yeah.
I was talking with other friends earlier today about Clarence Thomas's concurrent opinion, in which he listed three other cases that he says we need to revisit. And so he has taken the extraordinary step of spelling out exactly what steps are next in his efforts to dismantle human rights in this country. And a number of us have noticed that he specifically did not mention the one court case that protects his marriage. Mm-hmm. And it's the image of this man who is, to go back to our metaphor, at the top of the mountain, and he has no problem pushing everybody else down that mountain because he's there. And the one part of the mountain that he will not sacrifice is the one that he is standing on. Mm-hmm. This is getting to be a pretty ugly metaphor. It's effective, but oh my goodness, it's dark.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is all this to say, like, there is no guarantee that we could make to students in this moment that would be meaningful or honest. And if, as teachers and practitioners, we value an honest relationship with our students and our colleagues, then I think anything future focused, we've got to change the way we have those conversations. And yeah, and I don't know, increasingly I wonder if there is any space for optimism in those conversations, if what we need to be looking for more again is this idea of purpose.
You're using the word guarantee. You're talking about what education can guarantee. And my fundamental question is, can education ever guarantee anything? And you're already shaking your head, and I'm kind of skeptical of it myself. Like, I don't think our gig is to guarantee stuff. I think it is to offer things and to establish conditions where things are likely to emerge. But I don't think a guarantee is really relevant in the work that we do, because we're working with people in certain times. And because of that, there's this uncertainty involved that I think makes guarantees just outside the realm of what's practical for us. And yet, you've used that word a couple of times, and I understand why. And I think I can get behind your use of it. In the episode of your show, you worry that it's increasingly a cruel optimism that can't be fulfilled if we talk about this guarantee of education. And my question was going to be, do we need to shift the goal of education? Do we need to make the goal something different? And I think you just provided that answer, saying that our goal should not be to provide a better future, but to provide a better sense of purpose.
Yeah, I think so. And here we're getting in another little sort of knot to start to tease at, which is the role of the faculty member, or the purpose of the faculty member, or the intent of the faculty member to make offerings, right? And to suggest and to help students see, you know, a range of possible selves, possible opportunities. And this idea, like, I liked your use of the word offering there. And then what the university is selling, right? Mm-hmm. Which very much is wrapped in a kind of guarantee, right? Mm-hmm. You come to us and you will, you know, get a better job than your peers would, and you'll have access to these opportunities. And the sense in which, like, the marketing that wraps any kind of post-secondary qualification, a degree, a diploma, a certificate, whatever, is very much wrapped in a kind of a guarantee. Right. And we evaluate our degrees against that. How many students are working in their field of study 5 years out from completion, all that kind of stuff. And so I agree with you that guarantee is totally the wrong word. And also, at the same time, I think that a lot of students are entering our classrooms having been sold a guarantee or a kind of a promise. Right. And it's one of those things where, you know, when you're in grad school and you're getting ready to go into the job market and you're getting all this like well-meaning advice from people who hadn't been on the market in 20, 25 years, and it was a very different market, and you're just emerging into this space where you're realizing how little professionalization you have or what gaps there are, and you're trying to apply and you have all this advice that isn't helpful. And I often wonder how much of that we do to students all the time, right? Like, you know, I remember it, you know, when I was teaching composition full time and feeling like this total fraud, there was this component of the course that I had inherited. And it was like, talk about, you know, composition as a job ready skill. And I was like, okay, well, before this job, I sold pet food. Nobody ever asked me to write anything. I sold sweaters. Nobody ever asked me to write anything. I sold books. And even there, nobody ever asked me to write anything, right? I don't know what I can say about composition as a job writing skill. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any sort of frame of reference or conversation for that.
Yeah, I didn't either. While I was an undergrad, I worked in local theme parks and later for the local Apple store. I didn't write anything in either of those positions. After I got my bachelor's, I went right into teaching high school. And really, I didn't write things there that today's composition classes teach students to write. This is straying from the topic of this episode a bit, but I suspect many writing classes are designed for imagined students whose futures look much, much different from the futures many of our students today will actually face. I think social class and broad access to education have a lot to do with this misalignment, as does the changing nature of professionalization in the modern economic system. But like I said, that's a conversation for another day. For now, let's return to my conversation with Brenna, which we knew had to be taken in context. How do we maintain a sense of hope when we live in 2022 in North America? Like,
it's amazing that like you only emailed me last week. And since that email, like things got worse. It's not even been a whole week since we booked this call. And I was thinking like, oh yeah, no, this is totally like we are the Monday after the Roe v. Wade being overturned. And it's like, we're going to talk about hope, Chris. Right. Yay.
How are we going to do that? Yeah.
It's hard. Like it's super hard. And it has been a hard year for me, both professionally and personally, as it has been for so many, everyone, I think. And I've been wrestling with this for a while. You know, you emailed me after an episode came out where I talked about an interview I did with Naomi Hodgson, who's one of the co-authors of Manifesto for a Post-Critical Pedagogy. And in that, the collective talks about this idea of hope sort of as a separate notion from optimism. And so they're drawing this distinction between like the potential of optimism to be cruel in Lauren Berlant's thinking versus the necessity of hope. And they frame it in the way, this way of like a hope in the present. So it's not about a hope that is things will get better, which, you know, it's wild to think about. I recorded that interview about this time last year. And I'm speaking to you from Kamloops, BC in the interior of British Columbia, to Kamloops Tsleil-Waututh territory, which was on fire at that time when I was having this interview. And so— and
you mean literally, like
oh, I mean
ablaze.
Literally, yes, yes. The town of Lytton, BC is gone. It was here on June 29th of 2021. And by July 2nd or 3rd, it was gone. And that experience of living through wildfire, it was my first experience of that. I'm new to this region, already had me in this headspace of like, I'm already prepping a faculty population for a kind of resilient pedagogy. I hate the word resilient. What actually bothers me about resilience discourse is when the power is asymmetrical. So I don't want the university president to thank me for my resilience. I want him to staff all the units effectively so that they don't need to continue mining the depths of their capacity for resilience. That said, I prefer feeling resilient to feeling not resilient, right? And so when I talk about resilience, what I'm talking about is helping faculty to feel like they are prepared and ready for any eventuality. But you know what I mean? Like if the highway to Vancouver closes due to a flood, like it did last November, is your pedagogy resilient enough that you can meet students where they're at that week when they can't make it to campus on account of the highway washed away, right? And we live in a part of the world where we see more of that than lots of other parts, well, in a North American context anyway. I think here in the interior of British Columbia, we are in many ways on the front lines of climate disaster impacting us in a way that probably other than the Arctic or coastal regions, we don't see. I want a pedagogy that is resilient in those circumstances, that can be flexible enough so that students can be safe rather than being on campus as the be-all and end-all. And ultimately, I think that that is humane. I think that resilience isn't humane when it's get the work done no matter what, right? Which is honestly, I think how senior administrators have trained themselves to see resilience, right? We are resilient if we maintain our FTE rates in the face of a global pandemic. We are resilient if we don't have to close any departments this year, right? Those are resiliences. Business as usual is resilient if you're the person managing the purse strings.
Resilience, from that perspective, it involves bouncing back.
Yes.
To the same point from which you originated, which ignores the existence of everything that happened in between that caused you to fall in the first place.
Yes.
Which is then dishonest.
Which is, to me, resilient pedagogy is not any of that. Resilient pedagogy is a pedagogy. And I guess really, I mean, I think maybe I tend to have mushy thinking around labels. I will confess to that. And I think in many ways, when I say resilient pedagogy, I'm really thinking about a kind of a trauma-informed pedagogy. I'm thinking about a pedagogy that recognizes the particular moment that students are in and that faculty are in and that sees us as sort of in it together, right? And so I think that ultimately a pedagogy that is resilient is one that recognizes, like, oh, you know, there's a 1 in 100 year snowstorm and maybe the exam doesn't need to happen today. Right. Whereas everything that we are trained for in particularly post-secondary is like this show must go on mentality. Like, well, I hiked myself to school and there's no reason why anybody else couldn't. Less like an educational mantra than like hazing, you know? And I think that a truly resilient pedagogy is humane at its core because it's recognizing that people are individuals in individual circumstances, that we have shared circumstances, but, you know, we're not all experiencing them in the same way. And having empathy for that and having course policies and a course structure that is not so rigid that only one kind of student can fit, right? But instead, like, the most resilient structures are flexible ones, right? Mm-hmm. We read resilience as this kind of rigid thing, like it's going to stand there for 1,000 years, no matter what, when really, like, a skyscraper that is resilient is one that like moves in the wind, which is freaky to watch, but it's true.
It has to, right?
Things that are hardened and brittle are not resilient. And so maybe what we really need to do is embrace flexibility, embrace the flexibility that allows us to be resilient, and think of resilience less as I showed up to work every single day, no matter what, and more like I still actually feel fulfilled and self-actualized in my career 2 years into a pandemic. That, if there's anybody who's experiencing that, please let me know. But that would be an experience of resilience, right? Not just the fact that I just keep reporting to my office and become increasingly dead inside. Like, it's not resilient.
Well, okay, so writing teacher, every time you were talking negatively about it, you used the word resilient. Every time you were saying this actually might work, you used the word resilience.
Oh, I hate when people have English degrees at me. It's my superpower. You can't do that to me. That's what I do to others.
and I think that resilient is an expectation.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stick with that whole bouncing back thing because that still seems to apply in my brain.
Yeah.
And resilience is almost an orientation. Mm-hmm. It's a self-concept of I will find a way to hold on to what's important to me and adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas being resilient is, in your words, the being brittle and unflexible, which just means I'm going to stand firm and not change, gosh darn it, because I'm resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Which is different from I'm going to exhibit resilience and I'm going to flow around and with and all. Okay, now you've just given me lots to think about. Thanks for that.
Speaking of things to think about, let's talk about how Brenna's department works and the perspective she gains by being a learning technologist, not limited to being in a classroom. From her vantage point, she gets to see how faculty, students, and administration each react differently to changes in technology or protocols or policies. I wanted to learn more about what she's discovered from that unique vantage point. You work within a support department, which tells me that you see things through various lenses.
almost constantly. So you see the effect that policies, that constructs have on students. You see the way faculty struggle with technology. You see the way faculty are trying to roll things out via technology. And then you see the way that your department is trying to support everyone on campus simultaneously. That would help you. So how does hope get expressed differently from these different perspectives or through these different lenses? Something tells me you probably have noticed.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it's really fascinating. I transitioned from full-time classroom instruction to faculty support 7 months before the pandemic hit. New institution, new role. And in many ways, very much what I would describe as a unicorn kind of job. The way we structure faculty support at Thompson Rivers is a little bit different than at most places. So the folks at our teaching and learning center, and I am in our learning design and innovation team, so instructional designers, educational technologists, we're all tenure track faculty employees of the university. Totally fascinating. Makes for a really interesting dynamic because we see a lot and we are in a position to critique a lot, which is probably where my big mouth comes from. That's not true. I had it before I got here. As part of the beginning of the pandemic, we've always had office hours, typically run by my colleague. In the before time, they could drop by her office. She could help them get things sorted out, worked out really well. Jamie Drozda, if you're listening, is a fantastic learning technologist and really great with that kind of hands-on work with faculty. And then the pandemic hit, we moved everything virtual and we started having daily drop-in sessions for any kind of question. And this was at a time when there was no more on-campus engagement and many resources on campus had not yet figured out how they were going to transition online. And so we were kind of it in terms of a place people could come to ask questions and sometimes just a place people could come to just flail and freak out a little bit and panic. And I had this one great interaction with one of my colleagues. She was just flustered. She just needed to talk out what she was planning to do in her class. And at the end of the call, she said, "Oh, I always feel so much better after I talk to you guys." I was like, cool, okay, bye. And then I hung up the call and I was like, oh, that's why I'm burnt out, actually, because I'm just absorbing, right? As a team, we were just absorbing all the anxieties of campus. And in many cases, for students as well, we were answering calls from students that whole time as well. And so it was just like this weird kind of almost therapeutic relationship that was beginning to emerge. That was good for a lot of reasons. It gave us a tremendous position of trust for when we started to roll out over the summer. We did like this digital teaching summer camp. And for a lot of people, these practices were brand new, but there was a sense of sort of trust and confidence in us as a team and our care. Like we had demonstrated care through the initial emergency period.
Which doesn't often come from a department of, you know, teaching and learning support.
No, yeah. And particularly not from technology support, yep. Right? Like, as a team, we had established this good rapport with the campus community and also amongst ourselves had really taken seriously a care-centered approach forward. So from day one, our advice was strip everything back. Anything that's not a learning outcome, strip it back and reduce the number of assessments and consider reweighting your course. And have they learned enough to be done now in March, like for example, right? Those kinds of things, really sort of centering student well-being first and foremost. And faculty came with us on that journey largely because I believe they trusted us and because we were, for many faculty, the face of support in any context, right? But it also meant that we were having really frank conversations all the time with people in all kinds of different roles at the institution. So we knew really clearly like where people didn't understand policy, where ideas were being miscommunicated, where, you know, a particular language quirk of a senior administrator had been sort of accepted as like this kind of directive when it had not been intended that way. And we kind of got all of this information, which helped us to really, you know, shape and frame our programming and the way we talk to people. But it also meant that our office had this special, unique perspective on how to address those concerns so that people could go into that first September of the pandemic with something that felt like hope, right? Like we could we knew where the insecurities lay. We knew where the fault lines were emerging. We could try to patch the ones that we could, but also we could just speak honestly about them, right? And that is one reason why I think putting people in my kind of job in secure tenure track faculty roles, or at least secure faculty limited term contracts, but having that piece, I think the tenure piece is really important, but it's the academic freedom piece, right? It means that the person can say, like, yeah, I can see how that policy is not working right now, and here's what we're suggesting as a workaround. But being able to say, like, yeah, it sucks that you haven't heard from such and such responsible administrator. Like, that sucks. I'm sorry that that's happening to you. And being able to address that really frankly and honestly, having that space of critique as part of the space of support, I think that's really important. And I think it gets missed a lot of the time, because oftentimes the folks who are in the support roles, their employment is not secure, or they are not unionized, or they are not protected by institutional academic freedom policies, or they are in administrative positions and thus don't feel free to speak about administrative decisions. And all of that makes it really hard when a crisis hits and people just want someone to say, yeah, this sucks. No one is handling this well. The fact that you got up this morning and are breathing is great. Let's keep doing that. Which is not something that you can necessarily say depending on your institutional position and your sense of security, right? So I'm mindful when I talk about this stuff that I have a lot of structural privilege that goes into the way I approach this work that makes it unique. You know, my willingness to talk openly about, you know, things like surveillance technologies or all the other kinds of things that I think are so destructive that happened during the pandemic is very much an artifact of the privilege that I have in this position. But I also think, you know, to tie back to that honesty piece we were talking about before and kindness, like, I don't think you can give people, I'm thinking as I talk, this happens on my show all the time. Maybe that's the line between hope and a kind of cruel optimism, because if you can't be honest with people, if you have to sell like a particular version of the narrative, and that's the optimism that you're offering, I mean, it's going to be by definition cruel if it's not honest, right? Whereas if we can approach it with honesty and clarity and transparency, open as in hearts, I think that that's when we have a chance to dig at this idea of hope instead. And I feel like our faculty went into that first fall semester with hope that was meaningful, that was circumscribed by the context, that we'd had really honest conversations about what to expect in the classroom. But that is really hard to do. It's really hard to do because I think oftentimes, rightly so, folks want to come to a teaching and learning center and feel like they're getting a solution to a problem that they have. And I don't think I provide a lot of solutions. I'm putting it together, my tenure and promotion portfolio. I'm not going to put that in. Brenna doesn't provide a lot of solutions.
But she's hopeful. And that counts
for
something.
Super hopeful about her non-solutions. But I guess what I mean is, you know, I used to go to the Teaching and Learning Center before it closed at my old institution. It closed like 8 months after I was hired, the first place I worked, so it didn't last long. But like, I used to go and I'd get some great worksheets and I'd get some great ideas, but it always felt like this is a solution I was being handed to a specific problem that I had. My problem is attendance. Here's a list of ways to improve attendance in my class, rather than an opening of a conversation. Like, nobody ever said to me, why do you care about attendance? Which would have been a question that would have unlocked a lot for me, because that was one of those things, you know, I talked to John Warner for another project I'm working on, and he has this question, the folklore notion, right? Like, question the folklore that you're handed from the people who taught your courses before you. And that took me like 5 years to figure out that I didn't have to just do everything that had been done. I think that messy conversations would have been more conducive to improving my teaching and learning skills.
And talking about your position of privilege and the way that that works within your department and all of that, it made me realize you're saying that your tech team is actually presenting technology and technological solutions within the classroom as educators would. You're not saying, here's the answer key. you're saying, here's another idea that could complicate your thinking. Now let's talk through this and see what effect this new twist has on the assumptions that we had when we walked in the room, which is what is supposed to be going on in our classrooms. Students don't come to us for us to tell them the answer. Well, I mean, I'm gonna say it anyway. Students don't come to us expecting...
Now who's got cruel optimism?
Yeah,
go on.
All right, guilty. The connection that I was trying to make was that your department is approaching educational technology as educators, saying, here are other ways to complicate your thinking, and here are ways to enrich your understanding of the problem at hand, not to give you the solution, not to tell you what's supposed to work in this situation, but instead to help you think through your own rationale for reaching your own conclusion. And yeah. that sounds so delightful. Not only from your perspective of how to offer, because that sounds like fun.
It is fun.
if offering technology to a faculty member is just initiating a conversation and helping make people think through things, in my classes, the way I always say it is to make their brain hurt and mm-hmm. making them think too much about something, that just sounds great. And as a faculty member coming to you, if I know that you're not going to say, here's a solution, this will work, and if it doesn't, that's clearly my problem, is the implied statement that always follows that. Instead of providing solutions, you're going to provide suggestions for thinking through things and allowing me to reach the conclusion on my own. I'm all for that. That sounds lovely.
It is. And when you describe it as fun, it is fun. It, pandemic notwithstanding, it has been a really good fit for me. I came out of what I've described elsewhere as a not great fit in an English department, where I loved my students and loved the courses and had some really colleagues I was very close with and missed, but the general culture of the department was not a great fit for me professionally. To this role where I do get to mostly approach my work with a spirit of play, which is great. It comes from leadership. The director of our unit is Brian Lamb, who's, you know, an open guy from way back and who really respects the faculty roles within the unit and their ability to sort of explore the work however they want. And it, you know, I get as grumbly about my job as anyone does, and I worked too hard for all the wrong reasons during the pandemic. Like, I describe it as our team holding the university together with paper clips and bubble gum much of the time, it felt like. But day to day, you know, I'm reminded of it all the time. I talk about You Got This with people. People will say to me, like, wow, like, how did you get permission to do that podcast? And I was like, I literally never asked anyone. I just started doing it.
Didn't even think I needed to.
Never. I said to Brian, I think we should have podcasts. And he was like, that sounds rad. So when I just did it. People ask if our marketing department has to, like, give clearance or if I have to get it signed off on by anybody. I mean, chance would be a fine thing. I'm finishing editing those episodes like 20 seconds before they get uploaded. So, you know, good luck. Good luck with Final Cut. But all this to say, I think that it really does make all the difference in the world to have a learning tech team that is led by someone with a lot of credibility in the learning technology space, in the critical learning technology space, and someone who has a record of going on the record, having hard conversations about all kinds of, you know, technology and the institution and adopt all that stuff, because that trickles through to the expectations that are on the team. And it's one of the things, you know, oftentimes learning technology teams are housed within IT services, where the teaching and learning part is often stripped away, or they get housed within teaching and learning centers, where that core necessity to have a strong technology understanding and capacity for critique gets stripped away, right? And that's not the case everywhere. And there are people doing wonderful work at all sorts of institutions. But I think structurally, a learning technology team led by learning technology is a really good and extremely rare thing. You infuse that with the spirit of academic freedom, and you've got probably a lot of headaches for administrators. I feel bad for Brian like 40% of the time when I'm out doing stuff. But only 40%.
Here's another thing he gets to deal with.
Yeah, exactly. We used to have this slogan around the office that I was supposed to try to do nothing actionable today. Like, nothing somebody was going to take legal action against me. Anyway. But yeah, no, I do think that's really important. And it speaks to a particular way of structuring learning technology as a teaching and learning piece, but as something perhaps a little bit different than the way teaching and learning centers tend to run. That understanding of the technology is really central. And, you know, we got that old adage that comes out of teaching and learning centers, right? Like the technology should never come before the pedagogy. And it's always already untrue, right? Because like if I walk into a classroom and there's no whiteboard, that's a technology, and immediately my pedagogy shifts, right? Because I was planning to write all over that thing and now I can't. Mm-hmm. If I walk into a classroom, and everybody's probably had this experience where inexplicably none of the students have anything to like write down things with. It's like, oh, well, this is going to change the classroom dynamic entirely, yep. Right? You know, and Tim Fons has theorized this a bit, this notion of entangled pedagogy, like that the technology and the pedagogy are always in conversation with each other. And when you try to exclude one or the other from it, you are going to come unstuck, right? And I think when we look at the technology without the pedagogy, we make wildly unethical choices. But when we look at the pedagogy without the technology, we make choices that don't necessarily actually work in the real world for faculty. You've got to be able to tell people how to operationalize your wacky ideas, right? So if you can't have that conversation on like a nuts and bolts, these are the buttons you push level, you can't get to that next step of like, what does implementation look like? And is this working for you? Because why would they trust you to come back and when they've, you know, when something hasn't worked? But, you know, if your institution is lucky enough to still have learning technologists, I really think that we are in a moment where the value of folks who understand the technology, but also understand good teaching and learning practice, like EdTech has made so much money off this pandemic and they will only continue to. And we need people in place in our institutions who can ask critical questions from the perspective of teachers and learners. And your institution needs learning technologists, and those learning technologists need enough autonomy and security to be able to be critical voices at the procurement stage, at the implementation stage. Without that, we don't stand a chance in terms of maintaining a kind of independence over our education. You know, we know that every learning technology choice we make makes choices for us about our classroom, right? Like we're circumscribed by the learning management system or the video conference tool or whatever. And those choices need to be made with people who can ask the critical questions. And if there's nobody doing that at your institution, I think it's a good idea to ask why.
There again, we see the importance of being honest, of asking honest questions, of giving honest feedback, of making honest decisions that account for the needs of students and faculty, and of holding ourselves to account for the consequences of those decisions.
If we think back to the second September, which for many campuses was a return to in-person instruction, how refreshing would it have been to hear someone say, hey, listen, in our case, the province super pressuring us to go back, so we're going to do it. But we get that it's going to be hard and we're leaving some people behind. So here are some strategies for addressing that. Instead, it was, everyone's so happy with the return to normal and it's great for everyone and everyone's having the same positive experience and yay, right? That there may be people for whom that was a comforting message, but I have not met any of them. Because even faculty who were eager to get back to face-to-face instruction, of which there were and are many, even those people who were super enthusiastic about it had a lot of questions, right? What do I do if a student gets sick? How do I handle absences? Do I need to get medical notes when we are in a pandemic, right? Like, and there were all these things that were, you know, I want to reach students when they don't come into class. And the official line at most institutions was, well, we've gone back face-to-face, so you don't have to do that. Except that I care about and like my students, and I don't want to punish them. And also I want to encourage them to stay home if they're sick. So now I'm coming up with a solution on my own. Instead of having a university president say, wow, this year's going to be messy. Here are some of my thoughts about what's coming down the pipe. I know that this isn't going to be great for everybody. Why don't we talk collectively about how to best accommodate? I didn't see any of that. And that's exactly, you're exactly getting at the thing, which is that if you don't name the problem, then any solution you offer is going to be inauthentic and unhelpful and like so much Zoom yoga. Yeah. Like,
yep. Love that.
Yeah. Like I need another mindfulness webinar. Like I need an extra hole in my head.
Amen. Let's have fewer mindfulness webinars and more honesty in the way we plan for and respond to changing situations. We need to engage with one another, with our colleagues, with our students, and with ourselves, not with cruel optimism, but with honest hope. We should complicate and challenge our thinking about the folklore of our work and create opportunities for rethinking the status quo, for building responsive, flexible resilience, rather than becoming brittle and resilient. See if you can develop a sense of hope by grounding yourself in the present, working to build more empathy into the here and now. You've been hearing Teacher of the Ear. Just because the show is over doesn't mean the conversation ends. Everyone who contributed to this episode is accessible through Twitter, and so is the show itself. So along those lines, at Teacher of the Ear and at Chris_Friend, would like to thank at Brenna C. Gray, that's BrennaCGray, for chatting with me on today's show. Our theme music is by Blue Dot Sessions. This episode's cover art is by Aaron Burton on Unsplash. The show is hosted on anchor.fm, and you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The full catalog of episodes, including show notes and complete transcripts, lives at hybridpedagogy.org/podcast. That's hybridpedagogy.org/podcast. So that's it for this episode of Teacher of the Year. I'm your host, Chris Friend, from Kane University in Union, New Jersey. In our next episode, we'll hear Anne Gagne warn us about the pedagogy of complicity. Until then, let's all keep our ears open for more ways to empower educators and champion student agency. Thanks for listening.